at Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for informational and educational purposes only.
Better, stronger, faster.
Muscle Minds, this show is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You could use our code ADVICES at checkout for additional savings. And to support the program, as always, I'm here with Dr. Scott Stevenson in sunny Florida. How you doing, man?
It is sunny. I'm outside, so the dog barking will probably occur. People will know it's me. That's how we authenticate my presence, so there's no imposters.
And I hear something that I never hear this time of year. I hear birds chirping out there in the back. It sounds like a beautiful Florida day.
Yeah, that's right. It's probably, well, it was 80 in my house last night. I know that much. My air conditioner's not working, so it was warm. It's probably going to get up above 80 today, I'm betting. So,
okay. Yeah, that sounds nice, man.
Than Ohio. Yeah, it was a little chilly up there.
Yeah. I am not home either. I'm visiting a friend for a funeral in Canada. It's mm-hmm. only a few hours for me, but let me tell you, the wind here is brutal. Like, this is bad, man. This is like, it gets really cold. In fact, it was really nice in Michigan the day I left. And I thought to myself as I was walking out the door, I'll bring a jacket. Why not? Why not? I might need a jacket. And even with like a down coat, I'm still thinking to myself, oh my God, how many more layers do I have when I step outside?
And you're used to the cold. What's the wind chill there with the?
I don't know. I'm in a foreign land where they use Celsius and kilometers per hour. So in my car, it turns out Mini Cooper does not have the kilometers on the speedometer.
Shit.
Yeah, no. So thankfully, T-Mobile, shout out to T-Mobile, they have international service set up for me, and I actually had to like pull up a chart, and it only goes to 10, but that's all I need. So I can look at, okay, if it's 6 kilometers is this, then that means 60 is that, and I'm looking at my phone, looking at signs, and it's working though, man. I'm really happy to be up here. It's been an experience, like I said, I'm here for a funeral, but you mentioned the Arnold. We hadn't even really talked about it. I mean, I know it's been really a couple weeks now. I finally got to get a workout in with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I mean, granted, it was me and 10 other people, but
no shit, right?
But I did get to see the man at work, man. That was a lot of fun. Thank you for training with me.
Oh, yeah. What did we train? We trained back. Just back, right? Yeah. That was fun. Tried to play around with that machine that no one used at the gym there.
Yeah, a couple times. And I want to tell the audience, too, we were getting ready to start, and we're doing this. I put a video up of it. I think it was just on my Instagram story. Scott's loading up this machine. He's got one of those little drawstring bags that he carries with him with all sorts of little tools in there. He has pins.
In the guy's bag.
Yeah, he's got all sorts of stuff in this bag, and he's pulling pins out and strapping 45-pound plates to weight stacks. And he said, all right, guys, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do one hard set of this with drop set, and then we'll drop again. We ended up dropping like 5 times. He's like, and then we'll go find something else. You know, and then Scott, you looked at me as if to say, you know, it's up to you. We do whatever you want. And your words were, what was it? You said, so we could either do that and do a couple of really hard sets, or we could just do some fluff and bullshit for a couple hours. It's up to you. What do you want to do?
Yeah, I was trying to be convincing. I'd just rather train that way. I like to go in and, like, you know, just dive deep in, you know. Kind of see what you're made of type of approach.
I got something I want to ask you about training.
All right.
So, and I know usually we catch up first, and I'm going to go straight into it though. So, because I've been, you know, since I've been very influenced by you, And
thank you, sir. It's an
yeah,
honor.
oh man, it's intensity is something we're always talking about on all the different programs at Advices. And over the past couple of years of knowing you, I've better learned how to harness intensity. And that's what I've been doing. And I've been hitting back twice a week, and I end up doing one or two working sets per exercise, and that's all I have in me. So I wanted to do something different, just to try something totally different. And I went and trained with a gentleman here, Remy Berminga. He's a big show promoter for the state of Michigan and NPC and IFBB judge. I went and did a workout with him at his gym, Elite Fit Center in Belleville, Michigan. And he's like the opposite of that. He's been good friends with Jay Cutler since he promotes. He has Jay pose a lot of his shows and stuff, or make appearances, and he doesn't pose anymore. And he's done a lot of J style work. And basically, we did maybe five exercises, starting with pull downs into dumbbell rows, into T bar rows, into pull up superset with pullovers, followed by a hammer strength row. And everything we did was with like 30 to 45 second breaks, no pause really on any of the reps, maybe just a slight squeeze in the contraction, but a continuous rhythm. Not using centrifugal force, being careful not to do that. But there, it was very little work, very little rest. I would have to call that a pump workout. Let me tell you though, because it's so different than what I'm used to. The next day, my back was sore. 2 days later, man, I could feel like the DOMS in my back just walking down the hall. Like each time I took a step, my
I
back
believe
was like just fried, man. What do you think about what I did?
Well, there's a million and one thoughts.
Yeah, tell me everything you know about pump training.
Okay, here we go. Everyone get out the popcorn, set up the bed, ordering some of the supplies.
Right. Chapter 27.
Right. So there's a reason why periodization works. It's because your novelty of stimulus has a role, and weight training, in its various forms, is a stimulus for muscle hypertrophy. We've talked about this a bunch in the context of like daily undulating periodization in terms of the number of reps, the loading you're going to use in a particular set. You can grow with a metabolic stress type perspective. You can grow with a heavy loading type perspective. Matt Viev's like linear periodization model that is sort of was the standard for periodization, where you start off with a kind of a hypertrophy, and then you go to a strength and a power phase, or with lighter weights, and then heavier weights, and then very, very heavy weights. That would be more something for someone who's an athlete, a strength and power athlete. But bodybuilders can use that too. So there's you can those shifts in periodization stages or mesocycles can work. So that's a vi absolutely viable stimulus for muscle growth, without a doubt. And so that's one piece that has to be kind of weighed. The other thing is that you were kind of pointing towards muscle soreness as an indicator of what happened in the workout. And we could take there's a run they do in Colorado on Pikes Peak, where people run down Pikes Peak, and they run up and run down it, and they get sore as friggin' hell if they haven't been doing any downward running because of all the eccentric contractions. And so soreness, per se, is not an indicator that muscle growth is going to result. I could also just beat the shit out of you with a hammer, a sledgehammer to your back, and you would have been sore too.
I can hardly move today, Scott, after you beat me with that hammer.
Right, you're going to grow like a motherfucker. You're going to have a hunchback, which you're going to have if you let me keep doing this to you. So soreness is indicative of novelty of stimulus, but in the long haul, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got the best stimulus for muscle growth. So you can look at different insults that will all create muscle soreness, but not all of them will be equal in terms of the growth that you can produce. The other thing to consider, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, is that if you when you when you when they look at muscle protein synthesis, there's several studies that have done this now, where they've measured muscle protein synthesis at the beginning of a period of training, and you would think that first workout would be somewhat predictive of the eventual muscle growth that you get. So those with the greatest elevation of muscle protein synthesis, which increases in parallel with the increase in muscle breakdown. So the muscle protein balance that you see initially, at least the muscle protein synthesis, would tell you who's going to be a responder, who's going to grow well, and who's not. So people who don't get much protein synthesis, probably not going to grow that well, vice versa. Well, that doesn't pan out at the beginning when you look in the first workouts of a training plan, training program. But if you measure, and that's when you're getting sore, the sorest.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where the repeated bout effect is starting to take hold. So if they measure, there's a particular study that came out a couple of years ago now where they waited about 3 weeks into like a 12-week program, and then they measure muscle protein synthesis then when that repeated bout effect started taking hold. The soreness is not so dramatic. So you can imagine if you went and trained that way all the time, there would be some diminishment of the soreness that you experienced. So connecting the dots there with this muscle protein synthesis and soreness when you've just undergone a new or novel workout, which is exactly what that was for you.
Yeah.
What is going on here is that soreness may not really be predictive of how much growth you're going to get.
Damn it.
Of a novel stimulus.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
The thing that is that, and this is the talk that I think you were only there for the morning, I think.
Yes.
The seminar I did with John and Dr. Serrano. To Arnold. So you missed the second talk that I did.
Unfortunately.
It's all good. It's all good. So the bottom line there is the title of it was something like Unraveling the Mystery of Reps, Sets, Volume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
I wish I could have stayed, by the way. I'm glad that I got to see both you guys do your morning talks, but unfortunately there was so much going on I had to take off. I'm sorry, please.
Don't hold it against you one bit.
Well, thank you.
The thing that I do in large part there is I look through everything from, the relative value of concentric versus eccentric contractions and whether you should train to failure, do drop sets work, do cluster sets work, is volume the driver of muscle growth? How many times a week should you train? Like basically a lot of the bits and pieces that I've used to construct fortitude training.
Yeah.
I kind of dig through that. And so it is kind of a big puzzle. What am I supposed to do in order to grow? Like what's the best, what's most important if we can look, those are all the bits and pieces. Let's step back. Those are the trees in the forest. And what does the forest itself tell us? And if there are data out there, and this is something you mentioned True Nutrition, something Dante said for years and something that the literature suggests and supports is that at least when they've measured muscle strength, measured strength, that and there's one particular study that was a 2-year-long study with rugby players.
Okay.
Was probably the best piece of evidence is that the increase in strength that you get over the course of a training period is predictive of the increase in muscle size that you'll get.
Okay. And
that study with the rugby players, there actually was a correlation, I believe, of 0.88 between the increase in squat 1 rep max, and they were training heavy for strength. Increase in squat one rep max and increase in fat-free mass in those rugby players over 2 years.
Okay.
So that makes sense. I mean, that if you look at that correlation, the 0.88, you can just statistically speaking, you square the correlation and you get the relative variance explained by one variable on another one. So that tells you that correlation is pretty friggin' strong. That means about 8% of the variation in changes in lean muscle mass or fat-free mass, lean body mass, I think maybe what the term they used in the actual study, so maybe in DEXA, was accountable by or predicted by or connected to, related to, the increase in squat 1 rep max.
What percent was that?
About 80%. You square
80%.
0.8. Yeah, I mean, that's... 0.88 squared is about 0.80.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. I mean, that sounds like that's about as close as I think you could get to 100. You know, in a world where there is no black and white.
I've seen correlations of 1.0 before.
Have you really?
Yeah, a couple times. It's very odd. They sort of stand out, but that's a really, really strong correlation.
Yeah.
So, you know, and one thing, so that's, we know that, you know, if you train with heavy loads and then the relative increase in performance that you get, those people are getting strongest or having able to produce, of course, those, that means they can train harder. They're producing a greater stimulus in the gym. And then that's coupling with the adaptation of muscle size and muscle mass that you're looking for. Those things go hand in hand. And I'm getting back to your point with the workout that you did.
Yeah, no, I'm just following along. I'm just listening. I'm along for the ride now.
That's cool.
I knew if I told you that there was going to be a ride, basically.
The wrong ride, yeah.
Yeah, I'm on the train.
Press pause, go get some water, you know, come back. and the thing I looked to the studies, I could not find it. I'm like, what are you guys, why are they not at least presenting these data or something? Is that you can also increase muscle mass by doing a high rep metabolic stress type training.
Yeah.
They've done several studies now where they compare like 80% of one rep max with like 30% of one rep max. You get about the same increases in muscle size, especially if those sets with the lower loads are carried out to failure. So what I was really, really hoping to see, I dug in, I didn't see it, and it makes me want to contact some of the researchers. That Wernbaum's done this, and Stu Phillips has done a study, and Brad Schoenfeld's done a study. Those are three that I can think of off the top of my head, but basically with the same kind of model showing the same thing. Is, do you find that those people who are able to increase the number of reps that they're performing, or some marker, maybe the workload that they're doing in each workout,
yeah.
So those are the ones that increase, get the greatest increases in muscle size. I would guess yes.
That makes sense.
At one end, if you have someone who just goes, they increase the loads they're using by 50%, and you compare that with someone who, you know, barely increases the loads they're using, yeah. I'm guessing the person who used greater loads is probably going to have a greater gain.
That would add up.
Yeah. So when you step back and look at the singular tree in the forest of that particular workout that you did,
mm-hmm.
Which can, without a doubt, be a growth for a stimulus for muscle growth. I mean, Jay says that. I mean, Jay's physique states that clearly.
Yeah.
And the physique of many, many pros state that clearly. The question that you have to ask then is, in doing those workouts, my presumption from the data I just talked about, and don't know so much about the muscle endurance, higher volume types of stuff, but those people who can do that kind of workout and progressively overload in some way, shape, or form.
Mm.
People talk about, you know, that you cut your rest intervals. So let's say you do the same amount of work, but with you go from, you know, 90 second to 60 second rest intervals. Well, that's an improvement in performance.
There you go. Okay.
Something's happened. There's been a physiological adaptation, and that's going to be representative of more muscle mass.
Yeah.
There's adaptations that happen that will allow you to do that. More mitochondrial density, more capillaries, more enzymes of glycolysis, cardiovascular system will be improved somewhat when you, because training like that's a beast, as you know, like that's really freaking hard training.
Oh, my lungs hurt, but you know, like a little way in and stayed that way all the way through.
Yeah. You're gassing out, you know, in a big way if you're not used to that. But, so what you need to see, regardless of what it is, of how you're training, is some increase in performance, some adaptation performance.
Mm.
And there's an interesting thing, like this is another piece that people have probably heard me, people listen to podcasts have heard me mention several times, is that this notion of responders to resistance training tend to be people who have, individuals have the highest increase in satellite cell density, and they have the greatest growth factor response in response to a training bout. So you can look at responders, extreme responders, moderate responders, and not like non-responders.
Yeah.
And those things are predictive of who responds the best. And the limited data I've been able to find, I'm constantly sort of looking for more on this, is that growth factor elevation that you get, which is turning on the satellite cell activity, which is pretty much required for substantial increases in muscle size, that response is something that has maybe like the best guess, like maybe like a 4 or 5 day response time. So like maybe 72 hours afterwards, you're getting a peak there. And it comes back down like 96 hours or maybe the day thereafter. So that's something that if you're a responder and you get a great growth factor response. It does all those wonderful things for satellite cells. That singular workout is one that's going to manifest in terms of all the cellular adaptations and ultrastructural changes over the course of 4 to 5 days. If you're a good responder, and those are the what we see in pro bodybuilders like Jay Cutler,
right,
people who grow really, really well. If you're not a good responder, you're like more of a moderate or maybe, you know, even less than that kind of average Joe, you may not be getting the growth factor response from a singular workout that you need in order to like sort of reach the threshold. And this is just purely hypothetical, like it's kind of stabbing on my part. But my presumption, because it's such a major overhaul of cellular structure to bring in satellite cells and set up a new myonuclear domain and do all the things that those do, that there's going to have to be a substantial stimulus in terms of the growth factors that are turning on that process.
Wait, let me break this down. You're telling me I need more TH right now?
Yeah, just more farm grade growth. Not growth hormone, growth factors.
Oh.
GF, those sorts of things.
How much of that do I take? No, I'm sorry.
What you can afford. So it may be in order to perpetuate that satellite cell response that perpetuates the adaptation you want, that people who aren't as gifted in that department need to train more frequently, continually, more regularly boost up growth factors, and or just train harder. That's the thing, is like the dose response in terms of duration of elevation of those growth factors, or duration during which the satellite cell proliferation and differentiation is turned on as a function of just whether or not you're a responder or a non-responder, or exercise intensity versus exercise volume is unknown. We know you get satellite cell activity from an increase in number of satellite cells, or the things that happen when you get muscle growth occur in both with heavy loading type of training, and as well as metabolic stress, higher volume type sets, lower load type of training.
Yeah.
So those things happen, but you know what the best way is for individuals given their genetic proclivities is unknown. My guess though is that if you're a responder and that response with the growth factors lasts like 5 days or so,
okay,
you can train with a lower frequency and still get good growth because you're just so responsive to a singular workout.
Yeah.
And you can do things in that manner. So that's another piece of the puzzle. So you might have gotten really, really sore, but let's say that, you know, just hypothetically speaking here, you're someone that, you know, regardless of whether you train with half that volume or the rest of that's just junk volume, my guess is a lot of that may have been just junk volume for you, at least at that point. It was more than what you needed to kind of optimally stimulate growth response. You could have done like 2/3 of that and you would have, you would have gotten as good of an increase in protein synthesis as you're going to get. Chances are, actually, and this points back to what I was saying before about protein synthesis, is that the reason why the protein synthesis, when you're doing those initial workouts at the beginning of a training plan, when you're getting really sore, is not predictive of muscle growth, is because that protein synthesis is there just to cover the muscle damage that you've incurred.
Okay.
It's not accruing muscle protein. In a way that, you know, gives you a positive protein balance.
You're saying like just trying to keep up to be normal, to stay where you're at.
Yeah, exactly. Like wow. you want to have a remodeling such that you get more myofibrils in a larger cell a little bit, you know, incrementally workout after workout.
Yeah.
But if you just destroy the muscle and you get so sore, you've got so much damage that was incurred that the protein synthesis is just representative of damage repair rather than protein accrual.
Okay.
You want to build up the protein. So that's the thing, is like, what's the appropriate dose to stimulate protein synthesis in a way that gives you a positive protein balance? And isn't, you know, this is a hormetic type thing, like I've talked about. You know, you've got sort of an optimal dose. You go too far, you're not going to get good adaptation in terms of protein synthesis, because you only have so much protein synthetic resources. You can only turn that on to some degree.
Okay.
So, you know, let's say that if you're, you know, like on a 0 to 10 scale, 10 is the maximal protein synthetic response you can get. And you incur so much damage that that all of that is going just to repairing the protein that you that is broken down because of the actual damage incurred in the workout and then the inflammatory response thereafter, that you all your protein synthesis capacity is gone just to repair, and you're going to go nowhere. You're not going to make any gains that way.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. You know, initially I thought to myself, yeah, this is different, and I feel like I got, you know, a lot out of this. I'm going to give it a try for a while consistently. Yeah, I'm on the fence now because after that I had a couple more workouts and then I had to leave town. So I'm kind of back to next time I train, it's going to be like starting my cycle over. And I don't know. Well, I'm going to reinvestigate it though. But you know what? It was something that I felt almost like doing that workout. I'm like, oh, I better not tell Scott about this one.
No. I mean, you can do that. I think here's the thing too, is I imagine you've been learning over the last few years how to train harder.
Yes. I would hope.
Yeah. And the bottom line too, that I make in that talk as well, is that, you know, effort is going to dictate the amount of volume that you can recover from. Mm. So like reps in reserve is the, you know, how many reps you have left in the tank is an important concept here. So if you do 10 sets with 3 reps in reserve on each of those, you could get away from that and recover. Mm. You know, if you did 10 sets to failure, that's a different deal.
Yeah.
You're not gonna recover as well. So for you, you know, you could, maybe that workout would have been more productive for you 2 or 3 years ago because you simply wouldn't have been training as hard. Because you couldn't, you didn't know how to.
Yeah.
And now you do. Now you know how to train harder than ever before.
It took doing something other than what I had been doing in the past. I see what you're saying. It took, like I said, the 2 years of learning from you. And you know what, too? I want to jump in here. The last several episodes, if you guys haven't noticed, I'll talk about something in my own training to you, Scott. And I hope that everybody recognizes I'm not just asking this stuff for myself. It's just that when I bring anything up with training, you always have, I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm going to learn something. And so all I can do is
being a selfish bastard, Scott. Come on, you know. God, yeah. I can't wait to get some free personal training from Scott, free Scott consult.
Some advices from Scott Stevenson.
There you go, advices.
But I did want to mention, though, if I can, if you don't mind, if I shift topics, the seminar. And also, you just did another seminar, didn't you? Did that just happen with Paul Carter down there in Florida?
No, it's this coming weekend.
This coming weekend.
Yeah, it'll be, if the podcast makes it out by Thursday.
It'll be out Thursday.
Okay, cool. So then it'll be 2 days after that, Saturday.
Okay.
It's Sebring, Florida at 11 o'clock. I think it's CrossFit. I want to say 816. Can't remember the name.
Is it on your social media?
It's all over my social media.
Perfect.
Yeah, so people can find that. And a guy named Jason Wolfe, Wolfe,
yep,
is selling tickets. There's a whole bunch of raffles going on. I think if we can find a place, both Paul and I are going to give somebody a personal training session.
Oh, wow.
Not at the CrossFit place, but at a regular gym.
Yeah.
We can figure out how to make that happen.
Nice, and, man. That's cool.
Yeah. It's for them. There was at the SunTrust Bank there in Sebring. It's been probably 2 months ago now. I think there was a guy who went in, and I don't know that he had really much of a plan. He was a little bit out of his mind, and he was going to try to rob the bank, but he opened fire and he ended up killing 5 female employees. Like, they all were women.
Oh my god!
So one woman had just started working there, and she was working several jobs. So there's 5 families who were basically put out. By this horrible, you call it a massacre, I guess, in a way. And
absolutely.
So the Sebring, hashtag Sebring Strong is the hashtag that you can use to find things online. And we've got a GoFundMe. They've set up a GoFundMe account, and Paul and I are, you know, doing this just to help them raise money. Jason contacted me. He listens to the podcast. And he said, hey, long shot, like, would you be willing to do this? I'm like, yeah, of course, absolutely. Like, that's exactly why I do what I do, is to try to help as many people as I possibly can. The honor would be mine. You know, it's pretty awesome that people would want to come listen to me, and that it would help, you know, these, what a great thing. All I got to do is stand up and talk about shit that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And it's going to raise money for people who really need it. I mean, that's just brilliant.
That's cool. And everybody who goes, it's obviously people that want to get educated. And it sounds like a lucky person is possibly going to win some training with you, man. Which
and Paul, too. Like, and I just, Paul. Yeah, because Paul and I, you know, we've gotten to be really good buddies and we chat a lot. And
so tandem? Like, you guys are both going to train with someone at the same time?
Well, he's going to train. I think he's going to train somebody, and I'll train somebody.
That's what I figured.
Going to tag team somebody.
That's what I figured.
That'd be too much.
Like, yeah, what no, else? That'd be too much.
Paul's got far too much knowledge. You know, it would just be kind of silly. Be like,
okay. I just wanted to make it clear because that's what what I thought it was going to be. Right. Would be an individual, but
I just had a funny analogy. It was like, oh, so win a free conversation with Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein. Same time, it's like, well, hold on. Can I just talk to one of them at a time? Because both of them in the same room, that's too much. Like, there's way too much information to be had from the two of us. So he's going to do a talk, and I'm going to do a talk, and.
I think you'd be more the Albert Einstein because your hair's weirder.
Yeah. But Paul's a pretty, you know, pretty big dude. I don't know if he wants to be the Stephen Hawking. I don't know, because Stephen was kind of slight and old.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of tough. both brilliant, you know. But anyway, so yeah, that's coming up. So we're going to do that this weekend. So just kind of in and out.
That's badass, man. And I didn't get a chance to hear Dr. Eric Serrano. I got a chance to see him there at your at your event, the seminar before the Arnold Classic with John Meadows. And I know that he was going to do some talking about female hormones, which that I'm really disappointed that I didn't get a chance to stick around for that part.
It was supposed to be sort of a I think the title of his talk is Everything You Need to Know About Testosterone. And because we had a lot of women sign up for the seminar,
okay,
it wasn't quite 50%. I did an informal count there while I was sitting in the back of the room listening to John, and it was, you know, probably 30 or 40%.
That's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. So, but Eric doesn't, like, he sent me his slides. I think he got to the third slide.
Oh my gosh, no kidding.
That's how he always does.
Okay.
Yeah. That's, you know, he just sort of gets rolling and, we just started talking about all sorts of things. And then we had a nice Q&A. We actually ran till like 5.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Something like that. Because we went, there was at Paul Callahan's Bullfrog Nutrition later on that night, there was an event that we needed to run off to. So we went and did that. We went like an hour over.
That's so cool, man. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Everybody got their money's worth then. No question, man. That's pretty awesome. I wanted to mention, I got a chance to meet Ken Kanekin here yesterday. And yeah, he speaks very highly of you. I have a huge amount of respect for him. He's the guy who puts Swiss together. And so he's had you out there. And he's had a lot of people out there. That we listen to on the podcast and, you know, people that we follow on social media and everywhere else and on the stage. I think it really blows me away. The more I do with pulling people together, the more I see the scope of just what he's been able to do with Swiss.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, initially it's like, oh, he did it in 2016. That was the first time I'd gone. He's been doing this for a long while.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, you need to do it again next year. 'Cause 2016 was so cool. He's like, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Hey, like, it's just too much because he does it all himself, I think. So he has a giant production team. So,
yeah, he said, right now he's preparing for 2020.
So, right. Yep.
Yeah. So he's taking this one off, which I was disappointed in. I didn't realize that. I wanted to go last year, but I had, you know, so much going on and I had the thought of, well, you know, I'll come next time. And now I got to wait 2 years to go. But it sounds like it's going to be really cool. He said he wants to do, I think, another steroid panel, which I think, you know, all that stuff that he has is really interesting. What was the panel that you were on?
The steroid panel, last 2 years.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it was initially sort of just a PEDs thing.
Okay.
And then they just started calling it the steroid panel because the conversation just went that direction.
Okay.
We were going to be a supplements, just sort of a supplements and steroids, and we just went right to steroids. Ben Johnson was on that first panel, the Canadian sprinter. He lives there in Toronto, who got disqualified for the Olympics. He beat Carl Lewis in the 100-meter dash, and tested positive for Winstrol.
Right.
And then so he was removed. So he was a controversial figure because he just destroyed the 100-meter dash record at the time. Mm. I even remember the there was an image in the Sports Illustrated article of him, and he's sprinting. He's ahead of Carl. Some of it was just because he had a muscular physique, but some of it was probably just because of the particular image that they captured him. And he's like, his arm was in front of him and his deltoid was just giant.
Oh,
this
man.
Big round delt.
Yeah.
And I remember there was like, you know, a big like red circle around the delt, you know,
no
like,
kidding.
How, like, obviously this is not normal. That's that sort of thing. So he was, yeah, he was there. Dorian Yates was on that first one in 2016.
That was cool.
Or at least for part of it. He had to leave, catch a flight. And Bill Kazmaier. So we had the world's strongest man, the world's most muscular man, and the world's fastest man.
Wow.
All on the same panel. And this past year, there were some more physicians, a little bit of a shift. And so it's interesting because each year it's been the two conversations have been different.
Of course.
This past year it was more where social media has really blown up just in the past couple of years. And what's going on in the fitness and bodybuilding industry was something that was talked about more so. Just the amount of extraordinarily high levels of drug use. Was something that was on the forefront of the minds of a lot of the individuals on the panel, because a lot of them were coaches, just seeing because it's become so their drugs are so available now, and it's the social consciousness of drug use because this is just a function of human nature. It's just like it's the easiest route, you know. You can use drugs and not have to train and diet as hard, and you can make impressive gains and look phenomenal. And you've got people out there who, you know, who push those things, just kind of a reflection of human nature, but it's kind of gone overboard a little bit. So that was the big repeated topic.
Sounds like that's what he wants to continue focusing on this for this next one. And it sounds like he wants to, at least now, you know, we'll see how things evolve. We have time before 2020 gets here, but it sounds like he wants to push that a little further and actually bring people out who have lived that real world experience to talk about what they actually did to kind of dispel some of that stuff. Kind of like, you know, I think that's been, and I told him too, I said, that's what we're trying to do really, you know, in a lot of cases with advices, when we talk about PEDs is disclaim that stuff. You don't need a gram, you know, on your first cycle.
Right. Yeah. That's the interesting thing is that, the information about and the availability of drug use is just so right there. It's so easily obtainable,
yeah.
In ways that it once wasn't. And so that I think that compounds on itself in a way that just accelerates drug use. And people, you know, you see this from the questions I'm sure that you get and the questions I see where people don't have any idea of what's going on medically with themselves. They don't know how the drugs are working. They know nothing about it. It's
horrifying.
It's really can be saddening sometimes. And it's really because if you, as a newbie, I try to always sort of step back at and be as empathetic as I possibly can and imagine it would be like coming into this, you know, without any foreknowledge. And you hear, you know, it used to be, you know, 10 years ago, people were talking about all the over-the-counter supplements that they might use.
Mm.
And now, because people are openly talking about illegal drug use on Facebook in groups that could, you know, easily be penetrated by law enforcement,
there's a
perception that none of this is taboo or illegal, or and thus it's not the physiological effects are minimal and the side effects are minimal. There's just... It's not the type of thing that people aren't talking about, like all the negative effects they have, and they may not even know because they're not doing blood work.
Or in some cases, too, it's just the side effects have become part of our way of being. We accept it. You go on your first cycle, and you just start TRT after you're done with that.
Right. And, so it's I think the perspective that one would have to gain in like really digging in and even just making more effort. I mean, just imagine a scenario where, you know, you can pick up creatine while you're doing your grocery shopping versus if you want to get creatine, you know, you have to, you know, meet someone in the back alley to get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or you have to, you know, make some extraordinary efforts and wait to obtain it. Just that in of itself, the immediacy of availability is going to weed out a number of people from even doing those things.
Yeah.
But you can go on open, you know, boards now and buy drugs really, really easily. So, yeah, that was sort of a big topic, and I think we'll probably continue that. And Rick Collins, the steroid lawyer, I think is kind of his moniker, steroidlaw.com, I think is the URL. He's been on it the last couple of times. He's, of course, invaluable, his perspective.
I'd really like to get him on an episode. I've heard him speak on podcasts before, and obviously, you know, he's a great speaker. Does a really nice podcast, too.
He's a great guy. I would bet I can probably get Rick on. He's a phenomenal individual.
All right, that'd be fun. Maybe we could get the three of us together.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That'd be fun.
Definitely. Yeah, we'll bring him on as a muscle mind guest, for sure.
All right. Well, listen, I didn't say it out the gate, but we have listener questions as always.
Yes, we
mind
do.
If we run to a quick break and come back and see what we can tackle?
Let's do it.
All right, guys, we will be back in just a minute. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. Guys, if you've enjoyed the education that Scott Stevenson has provided to us here on Muscle Minds, then definitely check out his book. That's Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. What we can get into the shows is just a fraction of the information that Scott has to share. He's dedicated his life, really, to bodybuilding, and he's filled the pages with all of this great information. It's super well organized, and I believe that you could take any physique to the next level. I'm not just saying that. I seriously believe that. I bought the hardcover. You can get the hardcover at Amazon, or if you're international, at Barnes & Noble. You can go to byobbcoach.com, and you can get the ebook there. It's a beautiful book. It's well written. He put his heart into this thing. Also, guys, check out fortitudetraining.net for his fortitude training guide, the plan that we talk about all the time here on the show. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, guys, and we are back. Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. We are going to the forum, forum.advicesradio.com, and that's where all of our listener questions are drawn from. So we have threads stickied at the top of the bodybuilding section. There's a thread for each show. Right now we are in the Muscle Minds thread. I'm interested in the long-term effects that anabolic androgenic steroids can have on facial structure. It's not something that particularly bothers me, but I recently stumbled across a photo of myself before I had ever used anabolics. And some of my friends who didn't know me said that they could barely believe that it was me. The main difference is now that I have a wider and significantly chubbier looking face, even when off of anabolics for several months. I'm curious whether this could be due to permanent structural changes of my face, or is it more likely fat storage from high estrogen? Obviously, this isn't something either of you gentlemen could answer, especially with no idea what I actually look like. I'm just curious to hear a discussion regarding some of the lesser discussed side effects of AAS use, such as face shape changes and any other things that come to mind that people may not be aware of. I think that's a great theme in general, don't you? That looking at some of the, like you were saying earlier, just right before the break, side effects. Is this something, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you can look to women who use gear, use steroids, and the facial changes that happen there, where the jaw becomes square. I mean, there are definitely facial changes that are androgen related. That's why women's faces are immediately, distinctly, almost, all cases evident to a man versus a woman. We see that, in a woman's face versus a man's face.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would we wouldn't be able to look at a human and be like, is that a man or a woman? And that would be like a continuous question. So, yeah, facial structure, facial beauty is definitely androgen related. I was digging around. Of course, you're not going to do any controlled studies where they give women gear and see how their face changes or something like that. But there actually was an interesting study where they measured testosterone levels in utero in the umbilical cord, sampled them there, and then they did a digital facial structure analysis of these individuals later in life, when they're full-blown adults in their early 20s. And the prenatal testosterone exposure in both men and women changed facial structure in a way that was predictive by their digital analysis. You have to go and read the paper to figure out exactly how they did that. But it was there was a correlation between various aspects of the facial structure that were uniquely male or female.
Okay.
Given how they did their analysis. So that's right there. That's about probably the best, most direct evidence you're going to find that androgens or testosterone impacts facial structure. So, and we know this in women, though. You can see this over time. It's a thing that a lot of female competitors are sort of keenly aware of. They want to make sure that they, they maintain their femininity as much as possible. And, everything, all the side effects like hirsutism, hair growth, and those sorts of things obviously are, things women are looking out for. But it can indeed change facial structure. You can see it over time if you pay close attention. So that could be happening. Like he said, I think he said, we can't possibly know because we don't know what his face looks like. It would be great, to have a before. And it's funny because, this is sort of like the questions we get. We're like, hey, how should I change my diet? And we're like, well, what's your diet? So he's asking, how might gear have changed my face?
Yeah.
We don't know what his face looks like before versus after. So one of the things, too, he said his face looked kind of fatter. In a way, it actually sounds like to some degree he's gotten chubbier or he's got more body fat a little bit. And one thing that can happen, I've seen this in people with who have sleep apnea. And I've seen this kind of in myself actually as an indicator of, I saw it literally before my sleep apnea was treated. And when I've gotten heavier, is that one of the things they do, as a surgery for sleep apnea, is they want to prevent your glottis from falling back into your trachea and blocking the airway. And they actually can change your tongue. They can move your tongue around or restructure your jaw. There's all sorts of oromaxofacial surgeries. There's several of them that can be performed move the jaw around in a way that it doesn't fall back, so the soft structures don't block your airway and cause the obstructive apnea while you're sleeping.
Okay.
And even there's a mouthpiece. I have one. It kind of hurts my teeth, and it doesn't work all that well. But it's a mouthpiece that holds my my lower jaw in outward protraction. So that musculature there can get involved when people get heavier. And if he has, this is just kind of a long shot guess, but you'll see this. There's actually a pro bodybuilder by the name of Luke Wood.
Yeah.
So who's Australian. Remember him?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He died a few years back now, but you can see it in him. If you look at the musculature under his jaw, it was huge. Even when he was dieted down, okay. He'd have the sunken in cheeks and all that kind of stuff. and I think he may have actually died in his sleep. I don't say for sure, but I see that sometimes, and I've always when I've asked people to ascertain, that's a indicator that there might be something going on, and that musculature gets overdeveloped in someone who's got sleep apnea, because they're having some involuntary attempts to like get their jaw out of the way so they can sleep. Okay. I would actually get some soreness there. I could feel that there's something weird going on with the musculature under my jawline. So that will give you, like, when your jawline, it's not really a triple chin.
Yeah,
it's muscle, but it looks like it gives your face a rounder appearance because that muscle there is large. It's in the base of your mouth there under your jaw, your lower jaw.
I see it. I'm looking at a picture of Luke right now. Yeah, I see that. I see that developing in myself, actually, now that you mention it.
Yeah. So that musculature, I mean, it's obviously antigen responsive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you get bigger, and that will grow, probably just in general. Like, you can also, some of that could be from eating too. Like,
sure.
You know, if you're doing a lot of eating, if you're ever really bulking, you're chewing a lot, your masseter will get tired.
Yeah.
The temporalis muscle, when I've been really like pushing the food and retaining a bunch of water, and you look like Frankenstein. You're chewing, you have those big bulging temporalis muscle,
right,
like on the side of your eyes where the Frankenstein's bolts would go, that were, I guess, holding his head together. Maybe that's where he hooked up the electricity to zap his brain into life. But so that will get big. So some of that roundness can be literally musculature. And sometimes you'll see, like in bodybuilders that have shaved their head, you can see the temporalis muscle on the side of their head is gigantic from eating a lot.
I can even just look at Luke's just jaw muscles themselves are highly developed. I see him in a picture here dieted down, and just all the musculature of his face seems very pronounced. I'm sure it's different than it would have been had he not been lifting and eating and probably using anabolics.
Yeah, so that could be what stenth or strength.
Yeah,
or
how, stenth. You were right.
Yeah. Okay. How what he's referring to, but it's hard to know without seeing his face. He may just have more body fat if he really, maybe he bulked himself up. If he dieted down to Skeletor levels of body fat, his face would look different.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that makes sense. I remember seeing it was actually listener Keith Allen. Sent it to me, and by sent it to me, I mean he burnt it onto a DVD and mailed it to me. It was an episode of that TV show Botched, where they fixed plastic surgeries, and they had sent in Lauren Powers, IMDb Pro, and they had actually shaved down some of her cheekbones. And I don't know if those doctors really know the science behind what Lauren had been doing this whole time, but they said it was from anabolic steroids or growth. It was growth hormone, they said, had her cheekbones had continued to thicken up over the years.
Yeah. I don't know the ins and outs of this at all, but there are a decent number of female competitors who use like fillers and some of those sorts of things, on there to like kind of fill in their cheeks, because they just, the fatty deposits in their face will change.
Yeah.
That remains changed even when they get their body fat back, and they can lose some lip fullness and some of those things. So they will, to try to like, even if it's not, something that necessarily was directly impacted by androgen use.
Yeah.
They will then, use plastic surgery techniques to, enhance the femininity of their face, like by filling up the lips, like fuller, more kind of bulbous, rounder lips is a more feminine type feature. So they may not be like, lips may not be flattening out so much per se from gear use, but they'll still will do some filler on their lips to counteract the other effects elsewhere in terms of body fat deposits and what have you. So
I noticed the body fat in my face has changed. Having, you diet down, you get real lean, and you get, like you said, that skeletal look to your face. I've noticed that when it's come back, the fat is it's changed. It just, I can't explain it exactly. I can't exactly quantify it, but it's definitely come back differently.
Yeah, and, I just thought of this too. If Stenneth does, if he's a sleep apnea sufferer, and he, if he does use a CPAP, but maybe it's not working. Like my CPAP will change. I mean, my face aged like 10 years in the matter of the first year of CPAP use.
Really?
Yeah. Horrible. It's awful. I mean,
God.
Yeah, it's terrible. Like people would always give Jordan Peters shit for that.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
How old you look, you know, like what's going on. But, I mean, I know, cause you know, I've coached Jordan on and off over the years, and he would send me his, you know, first thing upon rising, progress pictures, you know, and his hair would be a mess, and which it is a lot of time anyway, but
right.
He doesn't care about that so much, but his face would be just fresh from the CPAP mask.
Oh yeah.
So friggin' big. The pressure was just sky high. So the mask had to be like, you know, vacuum sealed on there.
Right.
He's going to launch himself into space and he's to keep the mask on his face. So the pressure and like the deformation of his face would be just gigantic.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And the nasolabial fold, which is kind of like the smile fold there, like just kind of on either side of your mouth, above your mouth into the side of your nose.
Mm-hmm.
That like that crease is really is deeper on me now. It happened right off the bat because it just that gets folded over overnight.
I'll be damned. I never thought about that.
Yeah, it sucks for. That's why I've thought for like the thing is with the CPAP at least last time I've looked, I look about every 2 years. I get a little frustrated, like oh fuck, I just want to get back. Hate having to carry the CPAP around with me, but I looked into the surgeries and they still don't have a great results percentage for that.
They do have, if you could use it, they do have other forms of masks. I use the full face mask because I end up mouth breathing, but they do have just like a little nasal pillow version. There are other options out there.
There we go. It's authentic. Hey, Blitzy. No. I'm a mouth breather, so I have to use the full mask.
Okay. I wouldn't have thought of that, though. So this goes further than just anabolics as far as a lot of lifestyle that sounds like you're talking about, too. Environment, right?
Yeah. I mean, it could be. I mean, that you know, if he's got a more of a toxic system because of gear use. You know, and he's just someone who just doesn't handle the toxicity real well. You can see that in someone's face.
You really can't you?
Tired, yeah, and that sort of thing. So there could be a bunch of things. If he's bulked up a bunch and not, you know, I'm not insinuating anything here, Steneth, but, you know, some people get their body dysmorphia can go into full-blown, a dysmorphic disorder in a way that once they get big, they never want to get small again. So their body fat stays higher. They always want to be big. So that could mean more body fat in his face.
Sure.
If he's still on, he could just have moon face. You know, he could have, D-ball or Anadrol face from water retention.
Yeah.
So, yeah, imagine then you got maybe someone whose estrogen's not under control. They've got a water retention from orals. They're toxed out. They've gained a bunch of weight. They've got uncontrolled sleep apnea, but they've got a mask that's compressing their face and kind of like messing it up. And like, yeah, you could someone with all those things lined up in the wrong direction, so to speak, you could end up not having a very positive impact on your facial aesthetics, let's call them.
Is there still enough time for me to quit bodybuilding and keep my looks? I think it's too late. They're gone. I better just try to get as big as I can, huh?
We've got faces for radio, Scott. That's all there is to it. There's nothing we can do about it. So we'll just keep doing what we're doing. We're good. Our gig's panning out so far.
I'm going to move on then to Travis. Next question. He says, could Dr. Scott please discuss the role dietary fat plays in building muscle and repairing muscle? Or are they largely overrated? Or do they not get the respect they deserve? Scott, do fats get respect? I don't even know where to go with that last part, but yeah, dietary fats.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, what your fats doing for me? Sorry, go ahead. just bust out a little tune. It's funny. There's lots of things that I'm kind of surprised. I think he just wanted to open this up and let me kind of ramble because I'm guessing he knows some of these things. So saturated fat, at least with natties, it seems to be important just having a minimum level for testosterone production. So obviously that's important. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. Omega-6s tend to be pro-inflammatory. There's a couple studies. There's one that did not show this, but there's at least a couple studies that have shown that fish oil supplementation enhances the muscle protein synthetic response to amino acids. So that can be important. A lot of people, it's not so much the case anymore, but back in the day, when people would start, people were first figuring out how good fish oil can be for you, people seem to be getting like a recomp effect.
Okay. From
taking large amounts of fish oil. Yeah, they would like literally drop a little body fat and gain muscle mass and like a really sort of a positive sort of effect from that. So the thing that's interesting about arachidonic acid, which is pro-inflammatory, versus the DHA and EPA, the fish oil omega-3s, which are anti-inflammatory, is that now you've got a scenario where you've got a hormetic response to consider, meaning that you've got anti-inflammatories, which are going to reduce inflammation. So you're training and you're producing an inflammatory response, which is responsible for the muscle growth. You've got one form of fats that's reducing inflammation, whereas arachidonic acids are increasing arachidonic acid, which you're going to get from like red meat, for instance, and nuts, things like that, increasing inflammation. We talked about this before. I think it was the time flies. Was just the last podcast we talked about arachidonic acid, Scott?
You know what? It's been. I don't think it was the last one, but I mean, I know it was in more recent. You know what? It might have been, but don't. It's been such a blur. Remember. The last month has been a blur. I don't know about you.
So many podcasts, so many conversations. But yeah, so there's the thing that our Bill Llewellyn's got a arachidonic acid product, and I was chatting with a guy after he actually talked at Swiss about that, and just saying, you know, I get so sore, and this guy gets pretty sore, got pretty sore too. And he tried Bill's product, and he got so sore, he got cripplingly sore, like okay. Obviously way too much.
Yeah.
So your fat, your inflammatory response, and generally the level of inflammation that your body has is going to be a function of your fat intake, and those fatty acids are the precursors to prostaglandin synthesis. So, and prostaglandins are very, very important for controlling intracellular signaling and inflammation here in this context. So, the fats that you're eating or that you're not eating are going to have an impact on literally just how much muscle soreness you get, which is, you know, as we talked about before, is you just can't throw that out. It's important for, at least as an indirect indicator of the stimulus that you've provided and the extent to which you're recovering from your training. So if you're someone who's, you know, who's got a healthy level of both of those, that's probably ideal. If you're a little bit lower imbalanced, it's a pretty complicated system, but those fatty acids feed in and compete for enzymes that are pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory. So your dietary status in terms of those inflammatory or anti-inflammatory, pro-inflammatory fatty acids can play a huge role on your recovery and how you feel. So that's the interesting thing, like, for instance, with the arachidonic acid supplementation, is I can imagine that, you know, you could have a situation where for some people it would be helpful because maybe they're individuals who don't get very sore and they don't elicit much of an inflammatory response and therefore perhaps not as much of a cellular remodeling adaptation. So more arachidonic acid for them is helpful as far as hormetic response, dose response curve goes. And other people, like this guy I mentioned I spoke with after the talk that Bill gave, it's way too much. So that's important. Another thing too that's interesting is fats actually get used up during resistance exercise. They're probably not simply because they can only provide ATP at a certain rate. They're not predominant fuel like during a set. But when you finish a set, you still have some, you're still restoring energy status in the cell. You've still got a disruption of energy status. That's why you have an oxygen debt that you're repaying.
Okay.
You keep breathing. Well, that's going to come to some degree from the intracellular triglycerides that are stored there in your cells. So they do play a role in fueling sort of an indirect way. And I don't know what, I don't know that anyone's ever looked into ergogenic effects in this regard. Hmm. They definitely get used up. Like Per Tesh, who's a Scandinavian researcher, I mentioned him in the that mind-muscle connection presentation I gave. He's one of the guys that the Muscle Meets Magnet and Target Bodybuilding books.
Okay.
A lot of muscle physiology related work. And he documented many, many years ago in his lab the extent to which muscle triglyceride can be reduced with resistance exercise. So having the fats there are important. And there's a really wide range of intramuscular triglyceride stores in the skeletal muscle analyses that I've seen in both rats and humans. It's pretty variable. So there's something potentially going on there that's been kind of largely unexplored. But like Dave Henry was always someone that I suspect, because we would use a low carb approach with him, probably. I only saw him flat one time when we really pushed really hard. He's never flat, always full. And I imagine he probably, because we had lots of fats in his diet, that he was always, you know, maintaining some muscle fullness through intramuscular triglyceride stores. So, of course, there's going to be an effect of muscle, or sorry, of fat in the diet on muscle cell volume. So there's going to be something there. I mean, that can have a pretty large psychological effect just when you're dieting down. Hmm. Dave Henry, as I've mentioned before, he would never be flat.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of fat in his diet. And I suspect he's one of those people who just, over the course of many years, he'd been eating that way for a long time, had undergone the cellular adaptations for lots of fat stored within the muscle cells.
Hmm.
So, and I think that it makes sense, people who've tried it both ways around, but if I know for sure that if you've gotten done repeatedly glycogen loaded, carved up, on a regular basis when you're dieting down, it helps you fine tune how to make that process work for you.
That makes sense.
You're probably maintaining, you know, some of the cellular enzymes involved with glycogen synthesis. And the same probably holds true for storing intramuscular triglyceride as well. So there's something going on there that's pretty largely unexplored as far as muscle triglyceride as a store for fat. And that probably... It doesn't carry water with it in an osmotic way in the way that carbs do. Glycogen complex it forms. Glycogen is complex with a protein called glycogenin in skeletal muscle, and the two kind of fit together.
Okay.
And that pulls water with it, and that's that ratio. People refer to like a 3-to-1 ratio, or it was actually a 2.7 grams of water for 1 gram of glycogen ratio. But the specific number, as far as I can trace it back, comes from a study of rat liver, not human skeletal muscle. A guy named Mike Sherman at Ohio State did some studies looking at estimating the amount of water that's carried with glycogen during glycogen loading, and it's highly variable. It's all over the place. It's not like a particular number. That's why some people load up really well and others don't, at least one of the reasons. So anyway, so there's something to say for fats as a fuel source and for muscle cell fullness and maybe even the anabolic state of the muscle cell. When muscle cells get smaller, the protein balance is impacted by that.
What do you mean?
There's a guy, you can look up Heusinger, H-A-U, I think it may be an umlaut over the A, S-S-I-N-G-R, has done a number of studies with different cell types. I haven't seen it for skeletal muscle, but if you change the size of a cell, like if you crenate, let a cell crenate or get smaller, that will impact the protein balance or the anabolic catabolic status of the cell. So when cells are dehydrated, they tend to be more catabolic.
Oh, yeah.
Cells are hydrated, they tend to be anabolic.
You taught us this before, just simply, I remember this, just simply through better hydration. That's a way to effectively be able to grow muscle better, you were saying.
Yeah.
I remember that.
So when you're dieting down, too, don't let yourself get too dehydrated for long periods of time.
Okay.
It makes sense from a cellular standpoint. It's like, okay, so the cell now, there's a lack of fluid, and the cell is shrunken down, it's going to want to accommodate its size based on that. Like if the cell's shrunken down to be smaller, it's going to comedy side. It's kind of like the size of your house, like the square footage changed, you know, and all of a sudden like all of your furniture is compact and like pressed together, you'd get rid of some of your furniture. Okay. You know, it'd be a catabolic status. You'd start disposing of, in a catabolic fashion, the furniture and the things that take up space in your house, so you could, you know, maintain normal flow through your house walking around, because otherwise you'd be bumping into shit. It wouldn't work.
I want to know, I'm curious now, what percentage of our listeners just took a drink of water in the last 2 minutes?
Right.
Because I did. I I'm raising my hand right now.
Right.
I literally did. I was like, oh, yeah, I got to keep drinking.
Thirsty, yeah. We got to start selling some plastic jugs, man.
Dude, we could, like, just fill up bottles of water and sell it.
No. Anabolic water.
Yeah, anabolic water. There we go. At the Arnold.
Yep. A2O.
Oh, dude, you nailed it.
Hashtag A2O, yeah.
You
anabolic
nailed it.
Water. People would buy that shit. Yeah.
You
just put some like taurine in there and maybe a little bit of sodium.
And, yeah.
You know, sell it for like, you know, 100 times what it's worth in a big, cool gallon jug that was with like, you know, some like neoprene insulation on it.
Oh, yeah.
Say nice and cool.
I love it, man.
Put some skulls on there, you know, or something cool, you know. Yep, there we go.
With free refills.
Let me out. I'll laugh.
Free refills at the drinking fountain.
There you go. Exactly. So, yeah, there's something to say for, you know, maintaining cellular volume that fats can do. Not as much as carbs, but definitely there's something going on there. The other thing, of course, is, you know, when you're, especially if you're off season, you're trying to gain size, fats can be your friend. Like, eventually, you know, as so many guys know, like if you want to keep on gaining muscle, the weight's going to have to move up eventually. Mm-hmm. You can only eat clean, quote unquote clean, so much. So you're going to have to get fats in there in some way, shape, or form. So, and you can do that with monounsaturated fats and, of course, polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Okay.
And add calories, you know, obviously more than twice the calories per gram of fat compared to carbs. So that just provides energy to fuel the anabolic process.
Okay.
And then, you know, it possibly too, in a way, like this is another, I've never seen this studied, but it's sort of, sort of the idea behind this is that, you know, if you're like, so you're bulking up and you're taking in like massive amount of calories and your training volume isn't so high that you, you know, or any way, shape or form, like running out of glycogen, it's not like you've got any lack of carbohydrates such as your glycogen levels are ever becoming critically low while you're training. You've got plenty of glycogen. So you got plenty of carbs in your diet for that purpose and for most other purposes, which just need more calories just to fuel the anabolic process. Well, the more carbs you take in, this is purely, again, a hypothetical, just like stabbing in the dark. I don't think you'll see this study because it's so, you know, it's just so off the charts in terms of having direct health ramifications. No one to give anybody money to study this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just bodybuilders, you know, being meatheads. But it makes sense that you would use fats more so than carbs so that you wouldn't have excessive insulin release.
Okay.
Fairly, just for maintaining insulin sensitivity, potentially.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other topic, you know, running into loss of insulin sensitivity that doesn't behoove you. So you can add fats, you know, 1,000 calories from fats and not, and you still have plenty of insulin to grow, but not have excessive insulin in order to deal with those carbohydrates because you're using fats instead of carbs to get those extra calories.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, how do you handle fats? I bought some sorbet the other day and I was thinking about how many carbs were in that. And I was thinking about how many pints of sorbet you've probably put back in a week's time when you're really trying to stay full. But what about fats? We don't really talk much about your fat intake.
So it's all contextual. Someone asked me, I can't remember if I even answered the question because it's such a huge one, but this is in the Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book. So it depends on where in the course of sort of a year-round bodybuilding season you'd be in.
Uh-huh.
So if just after a show, I would start adding calories in a nutrient timing type way for various reasons. It's fun to eat big meals like that and go out with people and have a big meal. It kind of has a psychological benefit. You get to eat a lot of sushi or sorbet or pancakes or what have you.
Right.
And that's great to do. And eventually I would, you know, you'd max out those meals. And I've had really good success with clients really focusing during the beginning of an off season, at least, in a very much of a nutrient timing type approach, where they're packing down the food as much as they can on those days and trying to stay even a little bit hungry on non-training days.
Mm.
Even so, there's like a little bit of a hunger, like nothing that in any way is stressful,
yeah.
but you're ready to eat. So when it's time comes for to add a peri-workout recovery supplementation drink in, and then post-workout, those calories go down really, really easily. But eventually you max that out. And if you want to continue to grow and you've got time before you need to diet down, you need to start adding calories. And this actually, it's funny you say that, because this is part of the rationale behind that. Normally on non-training days, I wouldn't have, it would be a lower carb approach because you're getting plenty of carbs in. You got the advantage of the nutrient timing, that insulin sensitivity is higher from the training.
Yeah.
So you're, in a way, you know, hate to use this word, but the carbs are being preferentially, quote unquote, shuttled towards that high insulin sensitivity tissue, the skeletal muscle you just trained. So you take in carbs, you know, 2 days after you trained, they're going to be distributed wherever the glycogen might be low and potentially to your liver and just sort of throughout the body. Whereas you compare that with just post-workout where you trained legs, those carbs are going to go to the previously trained skeletal muscle.
Okay.
It's lowering glycogen. There's an insulin-like effect of contraction that increases insulin sensitivity. So you've loaded up the carbs, you've done all that, and now you've got a situation where you're deeper into an off-season, you just need more calories. That's when I would start adding those on a non-training day as fat.
Okay, that makes sense.
You don't need more carbs. You know, you're already maxing out your carbs. You're like eating till you feel like you're going to come close to bursting on the training days. And so then you start adding in, quote unquote, healthy fats on those non-training days. And then some people, I mean, if someone's really friggin' big and they're making good gains, you know, that could, and they, you know, if they didn't find nutrient timing was effective for them, they might be having fats and carbs during all those meals. It might be like there's no friggin' way around it. So someone like, you know, like maybe in Jordan's situation, you know, it might end up being that you're just putting down, you know, 8,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
Something like that. He's gone up to 10,000 before. And in that case, you just got to get the food in. You know, you're adding macadamia nut oil to your chicken and rice. And what was the guy's name? He used to train with Jason Huh down here, lives in Sarasota.
You're making me jog my memory.
Squality, Anthony Pasquale. Remember him?
Yeah, I do.
When the USA's, he worked with Dave Floma for a while. He was going to be the next big thing.
Yeah, he was.
He was awesome, and he was like he just dropped out of the USA's. And actually, didn't win his card. He dropped out of the USA's like a week or two before.
Right.
And he was totally all in, like as hardcore as you get, like never missing a meal. And there was
he ate Chinese food every day.
Yeah,
I remember that video of him doing that.
That's exactly why I thought of him, because that was people can go look that up and see, like, he would go and he's just talking about he was so big and he had so much muscle mass and was so gifted and, you know, was I'm sure, you know, chemically enhanced in a way that, you know, allowed this to happen.
Yeah.
He was just putting it down. He had to eat Chinese food. There's no way for him to, you know, he can't be, you know, piddle around with, you know, this very particular, you know, dot your I's, cross your T's, nutrient timing approach when he's trying to eat that many calories. Of course, he takes in probably was taking in carbs at least after his workout. Mendelsohn, you know, another perfect example. He used to drink like 2 gallons of Gatorade a day or some shit like that when he was like trying to improve upon his world bench press record. He was eating 10,000 calories a day.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah. Like he never drank any water. He just drank Gatorade all the time.
Yeah.
Cause he needed the fluid cause he's so big and helping with digestion and just for his fluid demands. But he also he used whatever means necessary to get the food in. So, you know, just Gatorade. It was like, not the same. It was a smart approach, but it's like the movie Idiocracy where they used to put Gatorade on their crops. Have you seen that? But yeah.
He had to have
Gatorade all the time because that's the only way to get the food in and still get down that many calories. So for me, because I haven't really tried to push, you know, things up for a while in that way, you know, I would be adding fats, you know, but eventually down the road, you know, if I'm up about 6,000 calories, there'll be somewhat of a semblance of a nutrient timing approach. But if, you know, if I have to throw some, you know, yum yum sauce on my chicken and rice or what have you, then I'll do it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about mixing macros at that point, because you don't, you know, at that point in time, you're trying to push the ultimate penultimate limits of size that your physiology and genetics will allow. So,
yeah. Makes sense. So, now yeah. I want to throw something in. I just thought of this. So I'm not doing what you're talking about, but traveling, you know, sometimes I have a hard time getting all the food that I need in when I need to get it in, especially, you know, things have been kind of chaotic this past few days. But I've brought fats with me. And so I feel like I can work a little damage control by carrying, say, some cashews with me and eating more of those than I would have anyway. If I, not saying that, like, you know, that's an acceptable replacement for missing a meal. But I do find, though, that if I do something like that, I'm more likely to stay fuller than I would have otherwise.
Like from an appetite standpoint?
Muscular-wise. Well, that too, but you know, muscular-wise. Yeah. You know, it's going to maybe work a little bit more damage control on my side.
Yeah, so your muscles feel fuller is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Fats, yeah. It could be that you run a little bit low on fats and you're getting sort of a fat loading effect from doing that.
Yeah. Possible.
I mean, cashews... there's some really tasty cashews out there, man. They have some, like, really highly salted, like salt and pepper cashews, and those. Some of it could be just getting sodium and extra water in too. That you're doing that, yeah.
Sure.
But I mean, I feel better with a low carb approach. I have no problem like just eating no carbs during the day. As I don't have any carb cravings, and I've gotten used to that. I've done that, you know, for so many years, and so my energy levels are better when I don't eat a lot of carbs. Okay. I found. And I have no issue. You know, it actually keeps my appetite really low. The question that I was referring to on Facebook, I posted a video and, you know, someone asked, how do you stay so lean? And I said, well, I don't really eat carbs on non-training days. And that just keeps my appetite low. I'm just not that hungry. If I just follow that very simple rule, which is very easy for me to do, just don't eat any carbs. And I just eat the foods that I like. I like eating low carb foods. I just don't eat a whole lot. I get plenty of protein. And I do just fine. So it ends up being a very easy way to diminish my appetite and keep my caloric intake low enough so that I hold a pretty low level of body fat. But yeah, that's interesting, you know, that maybe you should add more fats, you know, in general, if it's truly the fats.
Well, cashew. What I'm saying is that I may miss meals traveling. And so by not, you know, so I'm trying to make up for, you know, meals that should have been in there at times, just due to circumstances. I found that in those situations that it helps me with a little bit of damage control.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you eat the cashews, do you end up then not having lost calories, or are you still caloric deficient?
Probably still. I mean, you know, I'm just saying it depends on the day or the situation. You know, I'm talking about the chaos of, you know, real world when you just, life isn't going, it isn't on the schedule I would like it to be.
Perfect.
You know what I mean? So I can't, you know, say exactly where it would be, but no, just making a side note, I guess, listening to what you're talking about and relating it to my own life here.
Well, that's interesting, though. If you end up like, so if the day that you don't eat as many calories as you would have otherwise, you're low on calories, and you've, even in the, with that case, adding the fats in where you normally would have had carbs, you feel fuller. That's a fairly strong argument that there's something about either cashews, the way you're eating in particular, you know, have a nice effect for you. Maybe you're low on, are they salted cashews?
It's, you know what, Scott, though, it's really any fat. Right? Today it was cashews, but another day it might have been peanut butter.
That sounds to me like you might consider adding some more fat into your diet.
Right on. I'll have to keep it in mind, man, and see. But, you know, after I'm back onto a regular schedule, I should be home here pretty soon. So you've got that seminar coming up in just a couple days after the release of this show. Any chance you'll get to hang out with Paul afterward or something? Maybe get a workout in or something like that? Or
he's coming in early, actually.
Really?
Thursday, yeah. So we're gonna hang out. He's fingers crossed. I gotta go check my house will be ready. He's gonna be in the kind of the guest room.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, doing things. So yeah, he's coming in Thursday, and then So we'll have, he's coming to 30. I have to pick up in Orlando. The price is flying into Tampa was like ridiculous. So I'm going to go get him in Orlando, like an hour away, and bring him back. And then we'll have Friday. We'll probably go train. Nice. Sure, we're going to train and have sushi, you know, and that sort of thing. And then Saturday's taken up. We got to, Sebring's like 2 hours away. So we're going to get up early and drive over. And then he flies back on Sunday. So I'll drive him back over to Orlando for his flight back home.
Cool, man. Well, it sounds like a hell of a weekend. If anybody's down there in the Florida area, you guys should go check this thing out. Check out Scott's social media. And, yeah, man, you've been doing a lot of really cool stuff lately. Really, many a seminar.
Yeah, well, actually, people are probably... See, yeah, I'm getting better at this kind of stuff. I'm going to plug myself here.
What do we got going on?
On Tuesday of just next week, so less than a week from when folks are hearing this, I'm going to be out in San Jose for the Mind Pump podcast.
Oh, you're going to do it. Sorry, real loud. I blew the mic. I blew the speaker up. Dude, this is the coolest thing ever. so excited.
Yeah. John Meadows. I have to send a big, shout out to John. He was out there and he was on the podcast 5-6 weeks ago, maybe.
Great episode too.
Yeah, it was. I agree.
Fantastic.
Yep. So John mentioned me to them, and I'm going to fly out. They'll have me in the studio in the morning, and they'll have a day to kind of goof around over there.
Oh, dude! I'm so pumped for this, man.
Yeah, it should be. They did a really nice job. They have a kind of an intake form.
That
they sent me a link to where I filled in topics. They actually wanted me even to expound upon the topics they'd be covering. So they really, it's not like and this is in no way meant to disparage any other podcast that I've done. You and I, obviously, we know each other and we hash out what we're going to talk about beforehand, but
absolutely,
they're going to know enough about me. Like they asked for like a mini bio and, what are the topics you're going to talk about? And I gave them some details. So they really inform themselves, which is probably, one of the important ingredients for their success as to who they're bringing on. So that's not like, okay, so who are you? And they don't spend the first half an hour like fishing around to figure out who they've got there. They know, they're going to know who I am to a certain degree and what I'll be talking about in a way that can lead us through the conversation, I think, in an intelligent fashion.
I love that, man. That's really cool. I can't wait. Please keep me posted. Please document this stuff. And please get some pictures with the guys for me.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
I want to live vicariously through you. Being a bodybuilding nerd and a podcast fan, man, this is big. This is really big. This is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know the podcast. I guess I wasn't fully aware of what a big deal it is to be on with those guys. But now I know. Once I started listening, I'm like, well, these guys, they're really, really seem like they're phenomenal individuals.
Yeah,
the podcast is really well listened to. So, yeah, any chance to help people out by letting me empty my brain, I'm more than happy to do so. For charities or for podcasts or whatever.
All right. Well, as they say up here, I think that how would I put it? I'm trying to work the word use into it. Use will have a good time. There we go.
All use guys.
Yeah, all use guys.
All use guys have a good time out there in California.
It was good. That's better than me. I don't even try to do any type of impression because I'm so terrible. But it's not good. It's not good. Mm-hmm. All right, man. I got to get out of here. I got a bunch of stuff that I need to take care of. And I think I'm going to go to possibly the YMCA today and get a workout in. So,
is it a good – some YMCAs are awesome.
I'm not so sure. It's basically the only gym in town. They also have and I didn't quite see them, I guess they're just around the corner, like little tie-ups for horse and buggy carriages for the Amish here. It's a very, very small, quaint little town. It's cool. I'm happy to be here. It's an exciting little place, and it's just like you had said, Scott, do something new with your life,
There you are.
And try something new. So that's what I'm doing today.
Excuse my ignorance, but I think Amish they're very keen on remaining fully clothed. Like there'll be not a whole lot of skin to be seen. If you run into any, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but if you run into any Amish who are training in full garb at the YMCA.
Well, I won't be able to get a picture for you. I don't think they'd like that either, but I will report back if I see that. Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, there was Yeah, I know a little bit. There was someone I knew who was Amish, and you would never know. And speaking with him, phenomenal okay. individual, just really loving, kindly gentleman that I knew many years ago. But he was Amish, grew up Amish, and never once tried to impose any of his beliefs upon me. Just a really, really great person. So that's the limitation of my. And he did not dress that way. I think he'd strewn away a little bit, but he maintained, I guess, a sort of an Amish spirit about him, and really good person. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, right on, man. Well, thank you for your time, and thanks for coming on and enlightening everybody with some muscle stuff once again.
Yeah. No problem, brother. Stay warm up there.
Absolutely, man. And enjoy that nice weather. Are you training today?
Yeah. Yep. Going to go hit it.
All right.
I think I'm going to go. There's a new gym. I've been posting on Instagram, new gym here in town. I don't know if they even have air conditioning. So, yeah, it should be fun.
Nice. All right.
Yeah.
Well, for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. Go to truenutrition.com, use our code ADVICES, and, of course, go to fortitudetraining.net and byobbcoach.com. You can get Dr. Scott's book there. Guys, for another episode of Muscle Minds, we will see you soon.
Adios.